Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is John Berendt, whose latest book is The City of Falling Angels. Earlier book is Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. John Berendt has been associate editor at Esquire, an editor of New York Magazine, and for the past 10 years working on a sequel to the monster hit Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. When you first went to Venice, because City of Falling Angels takes place in Venice, you had no idea at that particular time that that would be the subject of your book, or did you?
No, I went looking for a book. I didn't know what I would write about. I knew that Venice was a spectacular setting for a story, and I also knew that my first book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, had a spectacular setting, Savannah, Georgia, and so I was looking in Venice, and I knew Venice pretty well. I'd been there a dozen times before on brief visits. So I went in February of 1996 just to scout around, actually. And as it happened, 3 days before I got there, the Fenice Opera House burned to the ground. The shell was left, that's all. And I thought, well, this might be something to start with. And I began asking questions in Venice. I wanted to know who lived around the Fenice and what happened that night and what it was like. Well, of course, everybody in Venice was aware of the fire that night. It was a spectacular blaze. The flames shot up 150 feet. It was the tallest thing in Venice that night. And it could have burned half of Venice, but the wind wasn't strong enough. So anyway, I went there looking, and suddenly I thought, maybe there's something here. In fact, the fire was a very important event. It was a wake-up call to Venice, because Venice had been called a dead or dying city for two centuries, ever since Napoleon defeated the Republic of Venice in 1797. What they had in Venice was really a museum city. Brilliant architecture and art. I mean, that all had been made two centuries before or more.
The population had dropped in half. I was there for briefly in 88, and it didn't quite have a Disneyland feel. And it was in May, which means it was really pre-tourist. But you definitely did not feel as if you were in a living city. I mean, it felt kind of strange that way.
Well, that's right. In fact, Mary McCarthy, in her book-length essay, Venice Observed, says that everybody thinks they're the first person to notice that the city looks like a painted stage set. And it does. And it has an effect, I think, on people who actually live there full time. I mean, they feel they're in some sort of drama. They're on a stage. They're performing. And it does affect the way they see themselves, actually.
Is that kind of one of the reasons why these people are such characters? Or did you kind of seek out or wait for the characters to come to you? Or, I mean, what I'm getting at is Venice 70,000 eccentrics or the normal 50 to 100 eccentrics within 70,000?
Well, there's probably a greater percentage of eccentrics in Venice because of this theatricality of the place. I, of course, do seek them out. I'm drawn to eccentrics, and there's a reason I am. For one thing, they're more entertaining, and for another, these are people who have decided who they want to be, and they create their own lives. Their lives are their works of art. And sometimes it takes a lot of daring, because eccentrics exist outside the norm. And in fact, for a writer like me, I like that, because the eccentrics define the norm by simply being on the periphery of the norm. Everything inside the periphery is normal or ordinary. The eccentrics are not.
Is that what drew you originally to Lady Chablis in Savannah?
Yes, Savannah was filled with eccentrics. In Savannah, it's different. There isn't a theatrical aspect to Savannah, but in Savannah, people love to gossip. They love to tell stories. And what do you gossip about? You gossip about people who are behaving strangely. So the eccentrics in Savannah know that they are appreciated, if only because they're giving other people something to talk about. So that encourages them to be even more eccentric. And so that's why you have so many in Savannah.
Well, getting back to the story of the creation of City of Falling Angels, you've said in an interview that you weren't sure about using the Fenice as a setting because you figured that most journalists would follow through, but then they seem to have dropped it. Does that really say anything about modern journalists? Does it say anything about Italian journalists? Or does it say anything just about the length of time it took for the story to unfold?
The local paper in Venice, the Gazzettino, had a very diligent reporter on it, and he reported what he was given by the prosecutor. There's very little investigative reporting by the Gazzettino, and I was surprised. And so the story, it continued to be covered by the Gazzettino, but the international press dropped it right after the first few days.
So what happened? You went down there, you looked around, and you decided it wasn't a story, and you kind of gave up and went home?
No. I kept looking at it, and I realized that it was an important story because, as I said, it was a major challenge to Venice to prove that it was a living city in order to have performing arts. They didn't have a major stage for the performing arts. They didn't have an opera house, and this was one of the birthplaces of opera.
And people can see what it looked like in Visconti's movie Senso.
The opening scenes of Senso take place in its 1860s. It takes place inside the Fenice. And what the problem with reproducing the Fenice was that from all the modern photographs show the insides of the Fenice looking beautiful with its golden tiers of balconies. And there are little lampshades on all the little sconces all around the horseshoe. And that distorts the color. It makes it a sort of reddish glow, or, you know, warmer. But the gas lamps showed the color of the gold and the paintings exactly as they were. So the people who restored the Fenice or built it up again consulted Visconti's film Senso because they could see actual. In fact, it was the first Italian film ever shot in color in 1955, 6 or something like that.
At this point, had you run into some of the other wonderful people, or terrible people, if you want to call it that, who populate the city of Falling Angels?
I began to meet people I thought were worthy of inclusion in this book, because I wanted to give a well-rounded portrait of contemporary Venice. And yes, I began to uncover them. I mean, there was a man who is a descendant of the Curtis family from Boston, who bought a very important palazzo on the Grand Canal in 1885. It's the palace where Henry James came as a guest, and John Singer Sargent, and Robert Browning, and many, many important artists and writers of the late 19th, early 20th century. But this man has an apartment on the Piano Nobile, the major floor of this palace, of many rooms and high ceilings, and it's painted in plain white, that's all, very little furniture, and it's illuminated with cobalt blue bulbs, the same kind you find along runways in an airport. He referred to the palace as the Spaceship Barbaro, Ralph Curtis, and he invited me to come for liftoff. I didn't know any idea what he was talking about. What he meant was when we arrived there, we sat on the floor, there was no furniture, really, and he had a boom box, and he asked me what Apollo shot, moonshot, did I want to hear? And he said, well, I said, I have no, it doesn't matter, any way you want. So he had a whole selection. And he said, well, let's do the Apollo 15. So we sat there and listening to the blast off from Cape Kennedy. And it was so loud, it shook the walls of the apartment. And he was entranced by this. This is what he did.
I read this in your book, and your opinions do come through in an oblique way. You don't exactly say what's on your mind, but the wording tells us what's on your mind. At that moment, when he takes you into one of the most glorious places in all of Venice, and you hadn't been there, and you'd been trying forever to get in there, and he sits you on the floor and puts on this boombox, what is going on through John Berendt's mind, actually?
What's going on through my mind is, this is terrific. Because, I mean, I knew I would eventually see the gorgeous Rococo Baroque interior. Somehow I would.
Right.
But here I am, and this man is playing the liftoff Apollo 15, and I'm thinking, I couldn't make this guy up. He's perfect. Just let him do his thing, and he did, you know, over and over again. It was wonderful.
In one review I read, someone said, it might have been the New York Times, said she wondered, how did John Berendt charm his way into everyone's good graces? So let me ask you, because she couldn't, how did you manage to do that? You got everybody talking about everything. Eventually, some of them did shut up, because they suddenly got scared when they revealed too much. But how did you start? Did you just say, hi, I wrote Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil? Did you avoid it?
No, I mean, I introduced myself. I wanted to show my credentials so people would take me seriously. And they had heard of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil because it had been translated into Italian, Mezzanotte nel Giardino del Bene del Male. Also, after a year, the movie came out, the Clint Eastwood directed movie, and it was on television all the time. I don't know why, but they seemed to like it there. So they knew that I was the guy who wrote that. They were curious to meet me. At the same time, they were wary because they knew that what they told me I might put in a book. When I was doing the first book in Savannah, nobody believed I was writing a book. They thought, who would ever want to read a book set in Savannah? And then when 5 years passed, it actually took me 7 years to do that first book.
Right.
When 5 years had passed, they thought, where's the book? You know, they couldn't imagine that a book would take any longer than a year to write. So they didn't believe me. They talked to me without any fear that their words would see the light of day, and so they humored me and talked. In Venice, it was somewhat different. In Venice, people were much more aware of the press, of journalists, of the world. They're more worldly. So they were a little more wary. But I was living in Venice, which made a big difference. I wasn't racing through and had 2 days there with a notebook and a pencil and leave. But they saw me in the street, on Vaporetto's, and they became comfortable with me.
And at that point, you've been beginning to get money in from Midnight in the Garden, and you could do that, right?
Yes, that was the fortunate thing. I didn't have to scrape a living together while I was doing this.
So you just would talk to people and they would open up?
Yeah, they would. And part of it is, as I say, a semi-social. Although they know I'm working, and I was on duty 24 hours a day. That's the way I figured when I was in Venice. I know that if I'm asking questions, I should give as well as take. So I would tell them things that were happening to me, things I noticed, and they would become engaged in a conversation. It wasn't just a grilling of them by me. It was give and take. And people relax, and they're much more themselves when they do that. What I also do when I'm taking notes during an interview, yeah, and somebody says something absolutely outrageous, I don't write it down. Because if I did suddenly start scribbling, they'd know they said something and they would pull back. So if somebody says something really quotable, really beyond the pale, I won't do anything until a moment later when I'll slowly write the words down without even looking at my pad. So they don't know what I'm emphasizing, what I'm really leaping at. That much I don't let on.
Along with the story of the Phoenicia, which, and that's spelled F-E-N-I-C-E.
Yeah.
That's threaded through the story, including the story of the two young men who were caught for arson. Though it strikes me in reading the book that there's a lot of uncertainty whether they're guilty or not. Great uncertainty, in fact.
There's uncertainty in Venice about everything. And when I got to Venice right after the fire, I was told by one of the expatriates, we're never going to find out what happened. And that was what most Venetians said. We're never going to know because they're not accustomed to knowing for sure. And a lot of stories end with a bit of fuzziness because the Venetians are happy with that. They're satisfied with that. We look at things black and white, and Venetians are content to settle for a bit of gray. When the two boys were sentenced, the judge said there were others in the shadows. These two young men were not alone. There were others in the shadows who directed this and for whom a destroyed Fenice would be a trifle compared with what they stood to make in the reconstruction of the Fenice.
And that would be possibly mafia or...
Possibly. He didn't... And I went to see him. I was shocked to hear this because there had been no introduction of evidence in the trial. And he said, well, this is what we think. And I went to talk to the prosecutor, and he said, well, that's my theory as well, but we don't have any evidence. And the link to the money, I believe, was the father of one of the two young men, and he's just died of cancer, so we are not going to follow it through. That was okay for Venetians, though. They can now make up their own ending to the story. The mystery delights Venetians. It may frustrate us, though.
Were you disappointed that you couldn't get to the bottom of it? I mean, even after the Fenice had been reconstructed?
No, I wasn't disappointed because I understood that the whole ethic in Venice was built on vagueness and uncertainty and mystery. And it didn't bother me that if there were people who paid for this, that I didn't find out who they were. It either was the mafia, or it could have been someone involved in the construction business, and it didn't really matter who. In another story in this book, there is a locked or sealed box with I don't know what in it, but the sealed box, to me as a writer, is a marvelous thing rather than an open box. This one has letters in it, but...
That's part of the Ezra Pound story.
Yes, yeah. Yes, but... I understood after a while that I would have to be content with mystery, lingering mystery, and so I got used to the idea. I mean, it's not that everything's a total mystery, but there are certain fine points that do not become so clear.
There are about 10 or 11 different intertwined stories that you come back to, including the story of the Ezra Pound Foundation and the cheating, I would guess you could call it, of Ezra Pound's daughter by a couple who latched themselves on to elderly people and wangled their way almost into an inheritance. Though we're not really quite sure about that either, because of course
it's
vague.
It's not for sure that they did anything criminal. There was a character in the book toward the end who happens to mention, oh, it's the shameless exploitation of the corpse, meaning almost everything about Venice. Venice itself is, to some degree, a corpse of a city, and it lives off the past. People die, like Ezra Pound and his mistress, Olga Rudge, and leave letters, and who gets them? It's the leavings of the corpse that is a theme, not just in Venice, but everywhere, but particularly in Venice, which is itself a corpse of a city.
And that sounds like there is a direct connection thematically then between the story of what happened to Ezra Pound's letters and the story of the fight over the Save Venice Foundation, which became a fight over ego and not really over Venice.
That's right. There was a social divide in this group called Save Venice, which is organized to raise money to restore art and architecture in Venice. And they do this by charging $3,000 for a gala that you can attend, 4-day gala in Venice every other summer toward the end. It's very high level. You get, for this $3,000, you get to go to private dinners in palazzos. You get private tours where tourists cannot go. All of these things are sponsored by somebody else, but the $3,000 from each person, $3,000 or $4,000, goes directly into a fund to restore art and architecture. But it's very high level social, all of this, and titled people come to it. Princes, princesses, dukes, counts, all this sort of thing. And it attracts social climbers, rich social climbers who are happy to spend $3,000 and all their expenses too to get to Venice, to hobnob with people with titles, who have titles. Well, it could almost be predicted that there'd be a social split in such a group, and it became very nasty and very interesting to me, and it became public. And it also ensnared some of the local Venetians. It became a real to-do, and it was worth covering. It showed how some Americans misbehave when they're abroad.
You're listening to an interview with John Berendt, whose book is titled City of Falling Angels. Were there any little stories that you did not put into the book, or stories that you touched on but were really bigger ones?
Yes. There's a story I didn't put in the book, but I would have. I met this wonderful woman named Fiora Gandolfi, who was married to the most popular soccer coach in all of Italy. He had been the coach of the championship team in Milan, Elenio Herrera, and he died. And she wanted to put his grave in the Anglican section of San Michele, the island of the dead, where it's just a cemetery. And in this little section of the cemetery is Ezra Pound and Diaghilev and Igor Stravinsky and various other well-known people. She wanted her husband to be buried there in an urn. And they said yes, and then they said no, and they said yes. Well, he was an atheist. He was not Anglican. He wasn't, you know. So it went back and forth, and they'd said yes at one point, and she's an artist. She made this urn out of old marble, and she had it ready to have it installed in a niche in the wall. And they said, no, you can't. And the Anglican said no. So she said to me, would you write a letter for me in English to the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, to ask if she will solve this and allow my husband's ashes to reside in the Anglican section? So I said, sure, and I felt so sorry. And I wrote this letter, and she sent it. And by God, 3 weeks later, there was a big headline in the paper, Queen Elizabeth finds a tomb for Elenio Herrera on San Michele. I didn't put it in the book. I might have if I had more time. But
had you met Queen Elizabeth?
No, I didn't at all. And it was not even mailed by me. Fiora Gandolfi said, this letter was written for me by an American writer of some note. I will not tell you who, because I know a lot of people will be furious. The Anglicans in Venice were furious.
And you didn't put it in because of your involvement, or it was just one story?
It didn't fit. It didn't quite fit into the flow of other stories, although she is connected somewhat to some others. It wasn't neat enough fit.
Was there a lot more research done on the story of the poet who died, possibly, most likely, by a suicide? Did you do more research in that? Because that seemed to be almost a murder mystery.
Yeah, I did a lot of research on a lot of these things. I have 23 huge loose-leaf notebooks full of interviews and research. I really love to, now I'll tell you why, because I used to write for magazines, Esquire and New York Magazine. And the reason I decided to write my first book was that I got the feeling I was never getting deeply involved in anything I worked on. I had a column in Esquire, so every month I would do something different and I would get involved in it and then just for a couple of weeks then write it and do something else. I wanted to get involved, to get deeply, to wallow in the subject. So when I was doing each of these stories in Venice, I gave it as much time as it took. I went to see as many people as I could and read background. And then, you know, a writer procrastinates. I'm a great procrastinator. And what I do when I procrastinate is I research. I do more research. Instead of sitting down and beginning to write that particular story, I'll talk to somebody else. I'll read another book. And this way you get more and more into something. You are wasting time, but you're not wasting it completely because you're gathering more information.
Did you do internet research as well?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I didn't do it. I couldn't do it for the first book because there wasn't an internet to get on.
But this one
it's amazing
did.
What you can find out. Here's one example. I wanted to know how deep the water was in St. Mark's Square in the great flood in November of 1966.
Right.
How many feet deep? I went on the internet, on Google, and I typed in St. Mark's Square. I typed in flood. I typed in 1966, and I typed in feet. Bingo. 4 feet.
Really?
The first story that came up said it was 4 feet.
That's amazing.
Know what to type in. It's a game you play. But it's all new. You see, it would have taken me weeks before the internet to find out that information. Like to find a story, a contemporary news story, or whatever.
And you spoke a little bit of Italian. I read that you, at first, when you got there, you began taking Italian lessons, but that was giving you headaches and you needed to drink a little bit too much to detox from it, so you gave up on that. How much Italian did you have? Was it enough for a conversation? Did you have to tell them to speak slowly?
I often told them to speak slowly. What I did was tape record all my interviews and then work from to get a transcript. And just to check to make sure I had understood. And sometimes I took somebody with me who was conversant in both languages. I had hoped to be more fluent than I was able to be. At my age, I'm sad to say, learning a language is not as easy as it had been when I was 16 years old and was in Italy for the summer. When I learned very quickly, and what I learned then, I still have. It's automatic. What I learned later, it was a different mental mechanism. And also, there were quite a few interviews in English because lately, Italians speak English as a second language. It used to be French. Now it's English.
John Berent, I want to ask you about updates because this book was finished about a year ago, maybe almost a year ago, and some events may have occurred since. Has there been any change in the story of you have a glass blower, an elderly glass blower, and his sons got into a fight, and the result is these brilliant vases wound up in storage? Are they still there?
That is the one story that has evolved. In fact, I finished the book, I would say, only 4 or 5 months ago.
Okay.
But that has. Since then, the logjam has been broken. It has been decided that the loyal son owns those glass vases
Good.
And bowls. And so now they can be shown and they can be sold for a lot of money.
And these are vases that were made by a man who was observing the Phoenicia fire, famous artisan of glass, and made, what, 80 vases?
Made about 80 or 100 vases and bowls. He had sat in his bedroom window 30 feet from the blaze all night, 5 hours, watching and refusing to leave his house. He was known as the Wizard of Fire in Venice, being the master glassblower. And he was looking at the Fenice, which got to be 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It became a furnace, and he had been staring into a furnace for 76 years. He was 87 years old. As a glassblower, he knew exactly what he was looking at. And the next morning, he went and made a whole series of vases and bowls with all the colors of the flames spiraling upwards around the outside of these glass objects. It was quite spectacular.
Did you find out about him as you were researching the feud between the sons, or did you find out about his story about making the vases from he and his wife originally?
I found out about Archimede Seguzzo because I was asking everybody about the Fenice fire. I was asking a lawyer for another whole story. At the very end of an interview, as I was leaving, I said, well, where were you the night of the Fenice burned? And she said, I was on a train and my cell phone rang. My mother said, the Fenice's on fire, and my office was right across the calle from the Fenice. And she told me about that. And I said, oh, I know this one and that one and that one who lived right across. She said, yes, and you know, the fireman had to take a hose through the fire hose through the apartment of Archimede Seguzzo, the great glassblower who lived right behind the Fenice. I said, oh, really? So then that was the end of all the research I was doing, and I found out about this fantastic coincidence that the glassblower of Venice was watching this furnace of it. Anyway, so I went to see the Seguzzos, and I put all that together. Then I discovered sometime afterward that the sons were at each other's throats. That's how it all revealed itself.
Is that kind of how each of those stories evolved?
Yes.
That it was just a couple of times you mentioned that the people that you were living with would say, oh, so-and-so, and did you kind of a little light bulb go off, and you're going, I need to pursue this
light
one.
Light bulbs went off all the time. Yeah, and you know, when the poet who killed himself, well, that happened in real time while I was there. First, he leaves these graffiti around town. Loneliness is not being alone. It's loving others to no avail, which is one of his famous lines, and a very beautiful line. And it's been spray-painted all over Venice on wooden walls, temporary wooden walls. And everyone thought, oh, well, it was a publicity stunt. And he said, no, I didn't do it. Somebody else did it. And then 2 weeks later, he committed suicide. So clearly, this was a cry for help. It was not just a publicity stunt. And it went on from there. And again, then the complications set in as to what had really happened, etc. And it developed as I was following it along, step by step.
At a certain point, was it just because you got a phone call saying, listen, you were supposed to deliver your manuscript in a month and you have only 75 pages written or something like that? At what point, how do you know when there's a book? I mean, you're sitting there with 23 loose-leaf notebooks, over 100 cassettes, tons of ideas swirling in your mind, and you're writing one word a day. I mean, at one point you realize, oh, my God, I better get cracking here.
I knew how I was going to play it out. How do I know it? Chapters flow one from the other generally, and there's an audible click that you hear when it falls into place. And then it's downhill from there for each chapter because you know the whole arc of the story is clear. The end is, you know, exactly what you want to get to and how to get from here to there. When you start out a chapter, there are infinite ways of starting out a chapter, but by the time you're ready to do the end, there's only one way to finish it. That's the way it always happens with me.
Did you ever fall into the Harper Lee syndrome of writing this one great book and then going, oh my God? I mean, she never wrote a second book, and a lot of people take many years. Joseph Heller took a long time to get going with Something Happened. Did that happen to you, or did you just go, oh, it'll take me a while, I'm not worried?
Oh, I always intended to write another book. I never knew how long it would take, but people started to say to me, Harper Lee, Harper Lee, Harper Lee, only wrote one book. And I said, well, I'll do it in my good time. And people would say to me, you know, when I was writing my first book, they'd say, aren't you finished with the book yet? And I said, I don't owe it to you. I don't owe it to any publisher because I haven't got an advance. This time I had an advance and I did owe it to a publisher, though. But I knew I would just take my good sweet time. That's the way I do best anyway. Fortunately, I was able to.
John Berendt, you were an editor at Harvard Lampoon way back when. You wound up being at Esquire, and you wrote that column. How long was the column? How many years did you write the column?
12 years.
Did you have any interest while you were doing that in working on a book or even a novel at the time?
No interest at all. I loved working on magazines. I loved the speed of it all, the excitement. I would work on something, and just a few weeks later, there it would be. And I always thought, a book takes so long. It takes years to write, and then after you're finished, it takes maybe even up to a year to come out. And I was too impatient. But eventually I wanted to get involved in something in my work more deeply, and so I wrote a book.
How did you discover Savannah?
In fact, just the way I say in the book. I was went with friends on a weekend to Charleston, which is just less than 2 hours up the coast. And when we were through, they all went back to New York. I went down. I took a rented car down to Savannah. I had only heard of Savannah. I didn't know much about it. I knew it was this old southern town. The first time I had heard about Savannah was when I had read Treasure Island, because the map of Treasure Island is handed over to Billy Bones by Captain Flint at Savannah in 1752.
Even though it appears that the character of John Berendt has gone down there and suddenly there's a murder and all of this. In fact, Jim Williams was in jail the first time you went. You kind of switched around the timing on that one.
Actually, he was out on bail. But the story of in Midnight, the story of the murder and everybody else's story, it's not a murder, he's acquitted, the story of the shooting. All the stories are reported accurately. The only thing is, when I started to write the book, if I had done it as it had occurred to me as I came upon it, I would have to have started by going to see Jim Williams in his house after he'd been convicted for the first time and out on bail, out on appeal, and he would tell me all about this shooting. Well, I thought, that's no way to start this story. So what I decided to do is to introduce all the other characters in the book first, telling their stories as they happen, and introducing Jim Williams, too, in the very beginning of the book, before the murder. And then, bang, in the middle of the book, he shoots and kills Danny Hansford. I thought that was the right way to tell that story, the dramatic way to tell it. What I had to do, since this was first person, was to put myself on the scene technically before the shooting, to meet Jim Williams before the shooting and have a conversation. So that was a liberty I took. And so because I did that, I put a note in the book saying that I had taken some storytelling liberties, particularly having to do with the sequence of events. That's basically it. But I endeavored to tell the stories absolutely accurately.
Now, when you were at Esquire, I have here that you actually had worked with a lot of people who write fiction nonfiction. The names I have here, I don't know if you actually did work with them. Tom Wolfe, Truman Capote, Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal, Gay Talese. Had you worked with all of them?
I've met all of them. I worked with Tom at Gay Talese and Truman Capote and Terry Southern. Other people. The whole idea, though, in the 60s, was that Esquire was publishing these wonderful pieces that read like short stories, whether they were profiles or reportage. They were very literate, very literary, but they were reportage. They were the same nonfiction that people were writing elsewhere, but with a great deal more style.
I mean, because the idea with, say, what Mailer did, you know, in the Armies of the Night, or, of course, what Capote did even before that with In Cold Blood, you know, what's fiction, what's nonfiction? And it becomes very blurred, so that when we read something like Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, less City of Falling Angels because of your preface, which says, this is real, there are no composites, this is the way it happened. We do start to question what is real and what is being created, in quotes, for one reason or another.
Yeah. In fact, there are no composites in either book. There are some pseudonyms in the first book because I thought I'd protect some people's privacy, and they were not very grateful. When the book came out, they said, why didn't you use my real name? I have to convince people it's me in that book. So the second time, this time, The City of Falling Angels, they're all real names. There has been some confusion about what's real, what's not real, what's made up. As I say, the stories in the book, in both books, are all true. And then the first one, I took the liberties of moving them around. In the second book, in City Falling Angels, it's pretty much the way they occurred.
Well, what do you feel? I mean, you may have a stronger sense of creation of the documentary approach, but what do you feel? How do you feel about something like what Mailer did or what Capote did? Or what Wolf did? Even though I've been told by someone who was on the bus that Wolf was incredibly accurate.
Yeah, I think Mailer was accurate, too. And I understand that Truman Capote might have made some things up. I don't know what he did make up. But I didn't make up things so much as rearrange that major way in the timing in Midnight.
Okay, this is completely off topic, but do you know anything about the writing of To Kill a Mockingbird and whether Capote worked on it or not?
I keep hearing that. I don't know if that's true. I can't imagine it's true.
You know, she says that Harper Lee says she actually wrote it, and people who know her and have contact with her, a writer I know named Mark Childress, said she wrote it.
I've always thought she did. And I think it's a very convenient kind of fun rumor that she didn't. You know, that was almost inevitable. She didn't write another book. So people would say, well, of course she didn't write another book because she didn't write the first one. You know, it's almost to be expected.
Do you think, John Berendt, that you as a writer have any responsibility on a social or political level for what you write, or are you just telling a story?
Of course I have responsibility. My first responsibility is to get it right. And there's a very sensitive story in The City of Falling Angels that has to do with some possible illegal activity. Possible. So because there were the people who would be guilty of this, if that's the case, I was extremely careful to get the story right. And I also, this is the one chapter in which I sent quotes to all the people I quoted and said, would you sign a statement saying that you are quoted accurately here and that what you told me is true? That's the most I could do to assure myself that I was getting the story right. Beyond that, I'm not sure what you mean.
Right now, you know, we are living in an America that seems to have moved in some very peculiar directions. And a lot of the criticism does fall on the role of journalists in how, well, to start with, how come we have a Bush administration?
Right. Well, the criticism of the press is that they are supine, that they're not going after the story, that they're letting the administration get away with this or that. If that's what you mean, no, I would feel compelled to tell it the way I saw it, and I have in this book.
Do you ever think about being compelled to tell stories more of that nature, or is that just not your interest?
A political nature?
Yeah.
I have not gravitated. Mine are more socially, I mean, oriented toward society as a whole, social people living in the same place, not political. I haven't written anything political, actually.
How did you manage to avoid being seduced by that same kind of power and wealth that brought all those people in to save Venice? Because you suddenly went from being a journalist over at Esquire and New York Magazine to being one of the most successful authors in the world. Doors opened for you so that you were able to attend parties with barons and baronesses and kings and queens and
I'll tell you, I'm simply not impressed by them at all. I am impressed by the fact that other people are impressed. And that doesn't move me one slight bit. It's all ridiculous. There is a character in this book, this character is a real person, who is so overwhelmed by titles that he must surround himself with titled people. And I think that's patently ridiculous. I'm not at all seduced by the grandeur of money and social and high living social people at all. It doesn't appeal to me much.
Do you ever go back to Savannah?
All the time. I was there a couple of weeks ago.
How's Lady Shibley?
Lady Shibley does not live in Savannah anymore. She lives in Tampa. And I haven't seen her for a while, but I saw her a couple of years ago, talked to her. She's still doing what she was doing when I met her.
And you still go back to Venice now?
I went back to Venice in March. I haven't been back because I've been involved with finishing the book going around talking about it. The book is going to be published in Venice under the title Dove Cadono gli Angeli, Where Angels Fall. And it's in Italian, and I assume I'll be going back there to talk about it.
Have you gotten any comments, any emails, letters from the people in the book?
Many. Because what I did was I sent copies of the book early to everybody in it, almost everybody in it.
Now, how do the Curtises, the ones who own the Palazzo, Piano Nobile?
Patricia Curtis and her brother Ralph both like the book for various reasons. Yes, Ralph Curtis, the one who has the liftoffs and the boombox, he was very pleased with what he read. And his sister, who's totally different, was happy with what she read.
And Lovett and Guthrie, the two opponents with Save Venice?
Now, I've heard from Mrs. Guthrie, B. Guthrie, and she was pained to see all those charges in there, but she said it's a very good book. Good luck. Bob thinks it's hilarious. He likes it a lot. I gather from other people that Larry Lovett, who's the other side of this battle, that he's not happy at all. But
it's funny. I think he comes off better than the Guthries, but what do I know?
Yeah, well, there you go. I gather he's not too pleased.
And Mary, the daughter of Olga Rudge?
I heard from Mary de Rockefeller's Olga Rudge and Ezra Pound. I sent her the book and she thanked me. She sent me a letter, a very nice letter, and said that she'd read through it quickly and she liked the ending very much and she was going to go back and read it and get back in touch with me. I haven't heard from her again. I don't suppose if she took a quick look at it and was not upset by it that she's disappointed by what she read carefully when she reread it.
And Casson? The prosecutor?
Casson is going to have his version translated to him. He doesn't speak English. He's the prosecutor. He's a wonderful character. I'm sure he's going to like his part because I admire him enormously, and it's clear.
And the Phoenicia is open again and functioning.
It is open. It opened in December 2003, and the Venetians are not crazy about it because it's too new for them. But it's really, they're delighted it's back, it's there, it's functioning, and it's providing Venice with a life.
One final question about that is, what was your impression? Because, again, you avoid your own impressions. What was your impression, having first arrived at Venice, and it's an empty shell, smoldering shell, the day that you walked in for that first concert?
I thought it was a triumph for Venice. There it is, rebuilt. Looking very much the way it had before. And not only that, much improved in places you can't see. The air conditioning, the backstage mechanism was state-of-the-art, the moving of the scenery and all of that. The sound, I don't know. They were tinkering with the sound. I sat in a box. You can never hear very well when you're in a box. One of your ears is up against the wall, for one thing. So I wasn't crazy about the sound, but I'm no judge, let me tell you. I think that the people hear best who are in the orchestra. And that's the funny thing, because the better seats, when the building was originally built 200 years ago, were the boxes where people would come, have their dinner, close their little curtain, have their dinner, talk, and then they'd open the curtain for arias, and they wouldn't pay attention to the rest. The cheap seats were in the orchestra. Now the expensive, the better seats are in the orchestra.
By the time you left Venice, were you still getting lost?
Rarely. But when I went into unfamiliar parts of town, I was getting lost, yes. That happens. That's part of the pleasure of being in Venice, getting lost.
And right now, you have some ideas, but you didn't know, even in 96, when you first showed up in Venice, you didn't know what the book was or when it would be.
No, and it took 4 years.
To figure that out.
To figure out that for sure this was the book, and by then I had lots of stories involving the Fenice and things that were in it and around it, and I knew I could do a robust book.
So in 2000 you knew this is,
I signed a contract
in
2000, yes.
Okay, and you're nowhere near that now.
No.
But you do have a place. In your mind.
I have a place, and it may not end up being that. I've just finished this book, so I am going to devote a lot of energy to finding the next one.
One other question. What did you think of the movie of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil?
I took the money, and I haven't said much about the movie. I think that's the best thing. Actually, it was a difficult movie to make, and I thought Clint Eastwood did a very creditable job. You couldn't make a movie of the book, per se, because there's too many characters, too many stories. And you'd have to leave a lot out, which they eventually had to do. And I was asked originally to write the script, and I just couldn't face it. I said, if I do write the script, you'll have a 25-hour movie. The movie is a different animal from the book. And it's very popular.
You've been listening to an interview with John Berendt, whose latest book is The City of Falling Angels. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.